We have Dominic Perez with us today from Curtis Wright Defense Solutions. And what we're going to be talking about is extending full stack development into the sales and marketing space. And now a lot of people who are listening are going to be saying, wait a second. What does sales and development have to do with, sales and marketing have to do with full stack development? Because, the old engineer statement is, right, marketing is what you do when you have a bad product. If your product's good enough, you shouldn't need to sell it. Isn't that how it's supposed to go, Kurt? Or Dominic, you work for Curtis, right? Your name's Dominic.
No problem. Hey, Doug. Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of this, it ties back to just us kicking off this call, because we didn't have this title before we started this call. We kind of spitballed a little bit, and we came up with something that had a little bit of a marketing ring to it. And I know, starting out as an engineer, I was very much an engineering purist. The best solution is going to win. And as I advanced up through the ranks, about the time I was maybe a principal engineer, dealing with a lot of customers, I started to understand that it's important to be able to represent those products well. And we can call that business development, we can call it marketing, we can call it sales.
Yeah.
And there are certainly people that specialize in each of those disciplines. They can talk a lot about why they're specifically different, but generally my concept is you need to be able to get your product out into the hands of your customers, make sure they are satisfied with it, using it to the best of their capabilities. Just building a product, it's not Field of Dreams. If you build it, they're not necessarily going to come. And what I found is that by helping these sales and marketing and business development professionals from the technical aspects, we can be more successful together and we can find more traction in the market. And we find more traction on products, product Gen 1, then I'm going to get more funding to go build a cool product Gen 2 and do the cool engineering stuff that I think that a lot of people want.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and of course, I was joking a little bit when with the intro there too, but I think that it's, I think the notion that, marketing and sales does their thing and engineering does their thing and they talk to each other as little as humanly possible, that's a very antiquated way of running a business. And I think it ultimately ends up being destructive, which is, because of course, right, the, on the sales and marketing side, if you're on that side, you need to understand how what you're selling works so that you can make sure that you are positioning it properly and so you don't overpromise. Because, that's the oldest trick in the book for anybody that's in sales, is to just, whenever somebody says, oh, well, does it do X? Well, of course. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. but overpromising is one of the is one of the old hats for a lot of people in sales, and of course that drives people in engineering crazy, because you have people out in sales who are making all these promises. You have a product that may not be designed to meet those promises. It's really important, I think, to understand, for everybody to understand what the other side is doing so that they can help each other and it doesn't become adversarial.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of different strengths that people bring from their various domains, right? As an engineer, I probably don't know how to go and set up a trade show booth.
Yeah.
I probably don't know who to contact to even, start that process, right? Well, now today I do, because
now you do.
But years ago I didn't. I didn't know, how to contact editors at papers to get your press releases picked up. I didn't know how to write a press release. And this is kind of basic stuff. I didn't know how to, name products. I find a lot of really cool products. People tell me about them and I'm like, your name is what? How do I spell that? How do I Google that?
Yeah.
I mean, these are some basics that, if you can't find it, you're not going to find the customers.
I think I want to make sure I give attribution correctly. I think there's an old statement, right? They say, build a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door. I found that's nonsense. The way I like to say it is, if you build a better mousetrap, the world will walk right past your door unless you promote it. And I think that's kind of the bridge that we're talking about, is that, even the best product in the world that doesn't get promoted, people can just walk right past it. At the very least, you won't be able to charge what it's really worth unless you can generate the demand to where you can support your pricing.
Well, and I think the corollary or the ante to your mousetrap thing is, if you go and look at patent search,
Yeah.
There's got to be hundreds of better mousetraps, but when you go to Home Depot, there's two or three different options, and they've yes. probably been the same for 50 years.
Yeah. Precisely. Well, and you know, because the thing is, right? You know, if you know, if you have an industry standard solution that works, say, is 95% effective, getting an extra half point doesn't necessarily buy you all that much. And right. so I think that that's the thing is, right, you know, better is there's, you know, just because you're the, if you're a tiny, tiny amount better and it doesn't make a meaningful improvement, that you could still have something that's really hard to sell.
Very, very much so. And, you know, I speak to engineers because I come from an engineering background. Yep. And I think this concept, you know, not just applies to the products that you're representing, but it applies to yourself as well. You know, well, something
unpack
like
that
this.
A little for me.
Yeah, so exactly. This podcast is, sure. you know, something 5 years ago, I wouldn't have even considered doing. You know, why would I want to be on a podcast? Who am I? What does it matter? But now that I've started to learn that I'm building my image, you know, I'm not this huge social media kingpin or anything, but I spend a little time every week on LinkedIn. I build mm-hmm. up my connections. I interact with people. I meet interesting people. I say yes to podcasts like this. I run with a co-chair the cybersecurity community for the Technology Association of Oregon. Just getting out there and fake it until you make it. But, you know, you can pretend as an introvert to be an extrovert. It's almost like an act that you put on.
Yeah.
And eventually you do it enough and it just becomes natural. I do think that introversion versus extroversion is more where you get your recharge from mm-hmm. than necessarily how you behave in any given social situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. Completely agree. And, you know, I was going to kind of append with what you're saying a little bit too, which is that, you know, I think there's kind of this idea out there that, you know, you have to basically be like an internet celebrity in order to have an impact. And that's not necessarily the case. What you need to do is you need to connect with people in order to have an impact. And yeah, if you have a really deep connection with a comparatively small amount of people, you can still have a pretty significant impact. And so I think that in a lot of cases, that's kind of that's the introvert influencer strategy, right? You know, and instead of having 10 million people who sort of pay attention to what you say, have, you know, 200 people who are really, really interested in everything you say.
Yeah, absolutely. And diverging a little bit from, you know, the markets that I play in, that is a lot of this new kind of microtransaction, the Patreon kind of thing that people are finding a lot of success in and finding their niche and really, you know, building content, building products to really hit a niche. And if someone has a pain point or someone has an interest that they're really involved in, you don't need a million people to follow that. You just need that.
No, more. Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Then, so we work in defense primarily. We do a lot of electronics for, you know, aircraft, for ground vehicles, for first in communicators at the tactical edge, really rugged, mill hardened stuff. There's a trade show called AUSA. I don't know. There's probably 50,000 people that show up to this trade show.
That's a pretty good sized trade show.
It's a really good sized trade show.
I mean, you know, we're not talking Dreamforce or anything here, but still, that's a good sized trade show.
But I've worked in this community for, you know, coming up on 15 years now. So I'll go and I'm walking down the aisle and not everyone, but people are like, "Hey Dom, what's up? Hey, what's up?" So it's not that it's not Dreamforce. Yeah. I'd walk into Dreamforce. I think Reignite is this week and, you know, no one would know who the heck I am. But in this little space, I've been able to make, you know, a little bit of an impact. And those are people that they move around the community. This person might work for company X today and they might work for company Y tomorrow. So I guess we could have retitled this podcast, you know, how to be a little bit more introverted or extroverted as an introverted engineer and what some of those benefits can bring. And they can bring it to you and your career and your products in my perspective.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think the ideas are tied together, though, because, you know, what we're really talking about is basically saying, okay, you know, how do you build connections so you can, you know, kind of cross over barriers or gaps, you know, because I think that in a lot of cases, you know, the some of the things that create create problems with, you know, with companies is when you have kind of walls of separation between your functional areas, right? The engineers only talk to the engineers, the operations only talks to operations, you know, sales only talks to sales. And so then what ends up happening is you end up having, you can get an us against them from inside the company. You know, and that's the thing is, you know, what the people inside the company should be worried about is trying to make the best product or service they can so that they can serve, you know, so they can serve their customers the best way humanly possible and then make it better.
Yeah. You know, I started my career at a small Portland company called Critical Path Software. They eventually got much bigger and got acquired by eBay. So they do eBay and PayPal Mobile, and they've been through many mechanisms since then.
But back in the day, you used to hear that a lot. There were a lot of companies got acquired by eBay in the 90s and early 2000s.
But as a contract development company, and we did it a little bit different. We brought like whole projects or portions in-house. We weren't just a body shop. What I found is that we'd go and visit our customers, and these people that we'd talk to every week had never talked to each other. And they come in to the room and they're like, oh, hey, Bill, hey, Sally, or whatever. And they hadn't talked to each other since a quarter before when they were there last. And I, you know, I turned to my boss and I'm like, this is really weird. Why don't they talk to each other? And he turned to me and he said, it's fine. That's part of the value that they see that we're bringing. It's a little thing, but breaking down these barriers and getting people to talk and bring their expertise from their various domains is important. And if you have to have some external event trigger that, well, I wouldn't necessarily pay an engineering consultant to do that, but maybe it is, it's an event where you bring people together or you fabricate a challenge, you know, real team building, not necessarily playing games on Zoom meetings. I think there's something to be done by solving a real problem that brings those people with different skills and experiences together. It's important.
Yeah, well, it is. And, you know, I think that, you know, on the one hand, you know, because you were saying, okay, you know, is the best way to get people to kind of team build and collaborate to hire an engineering consultant? It's like, I'll go, well, if they're not doing it on their own and there's no other way that you're doing it, then I'd say yes, because generally speaking, you know, the value of, you know, of having your teams cross collaborate is really high. And if it's missing, it's almost certain that there's going to be some kind of market penalty you're paying. So, you know, hiring a consultant may not be the best way to do it, but if that's the way that works and there's not another way that it happens organically, I'd say yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this can happen. You can look at everything at different levels, right? Is this a product team? And maybe I've got 5 developers and a couple QA, and then I've got my tech writer, and then, you know, are those people talking together, right? And I see a lot of places that they're not. And the places that are more successful are people who are talking together and sharing their unique perspectives.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the things I'd kind of like to unpack a little more, because, you know, as we're talking about this phenomenon, is, you know, in the defense industry, right? I mean, just defense and government in general is known for having very, very, very long cycle times, as far as, you know, sales cycle times, long product development cycle times. You can have products that live for a really long time. And so, you know, what's your experience been like kind of navigating that? Obviously, please don't disclose any confidential information, but I'm interested to understand what your experience is like, because, you know, at least it would seem to me that when you're dealing in these long cycle time type of businesses, maintaining a sense of urgency and still, you know, keeping at a fast pace of innovation, I found that can kind of tend to be a challenge, you know, because, like, you know, earlier in my career when I was at Intel, and, you know, of course, you know, in some ways, Intel worked on fast cycle times. In other ways, they worked on quite a bit longer cycle times. You know, of course, their product development tended to go on pretty rapid cycles, whereas, you know, a lot of the other things that happened were a little longer and methodical, and it was a little more of a challenge to maintain that, just that feeling of a sense of urgency. I would imagine that it's even more so when you're talking about, say, like Gov and defense.
Yeah, I mean, and actually, I think it is probably a lot like your experience at Intel. Intel has this, you know, 3, 5, 7 kind of cycle thing. And you can look at the military as you know, maybe it's a 5, 10, 15 kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more stretched out, but it's still similar. One of the cool things is, if anyone's interested, the U.S. Army provides an open technology roadmap to anyone. They have a series, 2 a year technical exchange meetings. There's actually one next week. Unfortunately, I was a little slow to register, so I'm not going to that one. But we will have a team there. But they have these things called capability sets. And they're numbered in 2 year increments. So CS23, 25, 27, 29. And what they do is they get cross-functional teams together across the various services, and they figure out where they would like to be at those various points in the future. Mm-hmm. So I think anyone coming from industry that's looking at a roadmap 7 to 9 years out is going to go, oh my gosh. But in the DoD, you have to do that. But they've broken it up into 2 year increments. So CS23, that stuff is in experimentation right now, and should be starting to get fielded. 25 is going to need to start experimenting next year. So there is this layer of, you know, sense of urgency versus also carrying that long roadmap. And I'm not going to say, you're not going to come out with a new product for defense and get it to market in 6 months. You know, this isn't a web startup. This is, hey, we're going to do it rapidly. And so PacStar was acquired by Curtiss-Wright 2 years ago. So I've been with PacStar for about 15 years now. We were very rapid in the defense space. We can basically turn a product in about 6 months. And that is much, much faster and allows us to be more responsive to customer needs. And there are customers that need stuff urgently. A lot of special forces, a lot of, SEAL teams and stuff, they need stuff now. They can't wait 3 years for a product development cycle. They need to be on the cutting edge. But they're quick turn stuff, right? So they're not going out and building this infrastructure that's going to sit there to be attacked for 10 years. They're building an infrastructure, they're taking it in, that mission's over in 72 hours. And then they come back and they debrief and whatever. So it's a different mindset, and there's different echelons in the military that operate in different ways.
Got it. Well, and let's see, and I'm actually going to cheat a little bit, because I wanted to bring in a point from a prior conversation that we'd had offline. But yeah, I remember you were talking about the Army technology roadmap. So now, in your experience, have you noticed that there's, and again, don't give away any confidential information, but have you noticed that defense tends to operate on a converged roadmap, a decentralized roadmap, and what have you found to be the pros and cons of that?
Wow, that's a really big question, because defense is big. You know, the Pentagon is the largest single employer in the world, I believe.
And I can't possibly imagine how they could operate on a single converged roadmap, because even if they did so on paper, there'd still be different roadmaps just because they're so huge.
Yeah. So this is kind of the joke that I like to tell. So there's this big initiative in the military called JADC2. Joint All Domain Command and Control. So what that means is they want everyone, regardless of their domain, so air, land, sea, cyber, space, to be able to share information in real time or as close to real time as possible.
And that sounds like a really good goal.
It sounds like a really good goal. And they said, yes, we're going to do this. And the first thing that happened is each branch of the service went off and decided on their own solution for how they're going to have a joint solution. So the Army has this thing called Project Convergence, and the Air Force has ABMS, and everyone's going to go do it on their own. And they're well-meaning. They really do. And the idea is that, hey, we need to get our own house in order before we can start bringing things together. But there's a lot of similarities that you're seeing of what they're trying to achieve. You know, the Department of Defense just a week ago released their Zero Trust roadmap. So that's a roadmap for getting all of the, you know, the DoD branches to what is actually a very high level of Zero Trust implementation by 2027. Now, if someone from industry, someone in IT goes 2027, that's a million years from now, but it really is a roadmap, right? If you don't start on this path, you're never going to get to the end goal. And so there's actually some really smart people working on these really big problems.
Got it. Got it. Well, and I was just thinking, you know, the situation you described, which is where you have each of the different branches all kind of goes out and starts architecting their own solution. You know, it's easy to roll your eyes at that. But like, you know, one of the things that I, you know, Lisa, I saw when I was, you know, in, you know, my corporate career was that, you know, what would happen is, you know, say you're talking about, you know, say you we have our centralized IT group, right? Well, then what would happen is the engineering group would need something a little bit different. They'd submit it to IT. It would usually get rejected in budget. So then what they do is they'd basically spin up a little sub team and they'd put it together. And then you'd have some other, like say product roadmap planning would want something, you know, a little different. And so they'd spin up their own team. And so, Intel's not unique that way, but I think the phenomenon you're talking about, I think replicates in a lot of different places, just because it's, you know, maintaining a standardized, centralized roadmap is really hard to do in a big organization.
And I think that's pretty typical. And, you know, once an organization gets to a certain size, you can't do everything the same for everyone. You know, going back to the DoD stuff that we were talking about, the Air Force is really, really advanced in moving these, you know, joint communications efforts along. And then someone from the Navy goes to the Air Force and says, hey, what do you do about underwater communications? And the Air Force...
And they say, what are you talking about?
Right. It's just different, right? You know, your IT department may not talk about, you know, may not think about what your engineers are doing. That's a really typical one, right? They plan really, really well for what accountants and what salespeople and what other folks are doing, but they don't think about the engineers that may need to install software, or they may need to, you know, do X, Y, or Z, or they may be a little bit more intelligent and they need to tune some settings on their machines to make them work better. So I think that's pretty typical.
Yeah, well, and you know, one of the thoughts you just triggered there is that, and I think this is coming back to our original topic of, you know, of really building bridges between groups, is that, you know, because in some companies you'll have, you know, certain functional areas that that can end up essentially amassing more influence influence power. And the issue you can run into is that if that doesn't get counterbalanced somehow, that you can end up creating downstream problems, because, like, for example, in one of the other companies where I worked at, what ended up happening was, you know, anytime we wanted to do IT releases for, say, a new product, I think we had I think we couldn't do anything in the last month of a quarter. I think we were locked off for like the first 2 weeks. I think the first 3 weeks of every quarter. So I think we had about a 7 week blackout window every quarter from finance. And then I think we also had a blackout during like 2 weeks of close, a month one close. And so there was ended up being this really narrow window any quarter when we could try to release and test new systems. You know, and so of course everybody would be talking about how they couldn't stand the systems, they wanted them to be upgraded. And it's like, okay, well, in order to release and test something, we're going to need to put it into production at some point. And so, you know, I think that's kind of one of the things that can happen is that, you know, if you get two, you know, if you get one area, and of course, you know, IT does this in some places, engineering does it in others, finance does it in others. But you know, if you get certain areas that end up, you know, kind of, you know, casting too big of a footprint, they can make it really hard for the other areas that they're supposed to cooperate with to be able to bring the value that they need to.
Yeah, that's good. It kind of reminded me of another thing. You know, years ago, my boss and I were talking, and she said, hey, let's do X, Y, and Z, and we will build you the biggest engineering empire that you can stand. And we did. We were very, very successful. And then I looked up one day, and I had something like 30 people reporting to me, or maybe even more. And I'm like, this is terrible. So I spent the last 5 years. So now I have no one reporting to me, and I work just as a CTO of influence. So I borrow, I beg, yeah. I steal, and at least I don't have to do any performance reports every quarter. So.
Well, and you know, because there's, and I think that's actually very much a model of the future, because one of the things that I'm sure you realize very quickly is that, everybody, as they're going up, they always, fantasize about having this big empire of people who report to you. But as you said, you have to do all the performance reviews. You have to, you end up needing to have your just your regular weekly, biweekly, or whatever monthly one-on-ones. You end up having a lot of overhead that comes into the process. And generally speaking, you don't get paid anymore. So then what ends up happening is, if you're going to do work that's not just talking to people who are in your organization, that has to happen outside of business hours. So you end up doing two jobs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you've got 30 people and you wanted to do a weekly one-on-one with them, I mean, even if you're only giving them a half an hour, that's nearly half of your week. And it's not the right model.
Yeah.
You gotta build some structure in, and you gotta build people up to and trust them.
Precisely. I mean, and frankly, I think that the organization of the future is a lot more flat, and is, relies a lot more on cross organizational influence as opposed to positional authority.
I would tend to agree.
Outstanding. Well, all right. So, let me kind of take a little bit of a turn here. So is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't?
Should have asked me that I didn't. Maybe for the winning lottery numbers? I'm not...
I was going to say, statistically, winning the lottery isn't one of the best things that can happen to you. I like to think that I'd be the exception, but...
Well, what was that Powerball a few weeks back, Is it like $2 billion or something? I think it'd be hard to screw that one up.
Yeah.
You'd have to try really hard or buy a portion of Twitter or something.
And we're going completely off topic, but that's fine. I think there was, I don't know whether this is just an urban legend or something, but one story I saw one time was, someone wins the lottery, and then what they do is they call up all their friends and family and says, hey, I need to borrow $150. I can't tell you what it's for, but I'll pay you back in 2 weeks. And that was their filter to see who they were going to keep, in contact with after they announced they won.
Yeah. So no, I don't know that there's necessarily anything that you didn't ask me about. One of the things for people that are in our area, because I think Doug, you probably only live like 15 minutes from me, right?
Yeah, probably.
I live in Sherwood. We're both a little bit south of Portland.
Okay.
But for our local listeners, the Technology Association of Oregon, we have a great cybersecurity community. We have kind of fun, engaging network events with a mix of introverts and extroverts. We've spent a lot of effort building the community and helping people get careers in cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. There is a massive demand for cybersecurity professionals. There's something like 7,000 open cybersecurity roles in Oregon. And there's never going to be enough people coming through the university system to fill all of those roles. So looking at people that can be cross-trained is something, looking to bring diversity into cyber and into basically any tech area is something that I'm personally passionate about. And I'd encourage people to look at that. I see some layoffs coming around from some of the big players. Maybe you were a dev for Amazon or a product manager for Amazon, and your number came up wrong. Take a look at cybersecurity. I think if you're smart and you've been successful in another technical domain, you can be smart and successful in cybersecurity, really rapidly. There's definitely a need for it. And there are so many different job roles. Me and friends are jotting down, and there's at least a dozen, maybe more than 20 different roles in cybersecurity that people don't probably realize if they're outside of the industry. Everything from penetration testers, you know, the Mr. Robots of the world, down to people that are more like legal and accountants and ensuring compliance, and those skill sets can kind of transition. And there's people that just have to go and, you know, check the machines, check the logs. That stuff has to happen. So there's roles at all levels and for all different skill sets. So I'd encourage people to check it out.
Outstanding. No, excellent. And yeah, really appreciate you sharing that, because I think, you know, especially in the kind of, you know, in the evolving economy that we have right now with, you know, a number of the larger companies going through through cycles of layoffs, I think a lot of people are going to be pivoting their career. And I think, you know, sort of in keeping with our conversation, right, you know, the idea of a quote engineer or a, you know, like, you know, quote QA or, you know, kind of quote this or quote that, a lot of people are going to be crossing from one career path to another. And in a lot of cases, that's a really good thing, because you can bring that breadth of skills and abilities to be able to, you know, to be able to help generate ideas that might not come out otherwise.
Yeah. You know, some of the best software developers that I know, almost none of them went for computer science. They're physicists that, all the other physicists couldn't get the software to work.
Yeah.
So I spent that, or they're a chemist, or, you know, they may have gone for something completely different, but they found a way to pivot to that industry. I really think that cyber is to the 2020s what software was to the 90s and 2000s. It's an area that's not as developed yet. It's an area with opportunity for people that don't have a formal education in it. Check it out.
Yeah. Outstanding. Hey, well, Dominic, really, really appreciate your time today.
It's been great.